And heading offshore, Australian troops were in Afghanistan for 12 years, our longest overseas combat deployment. Now, a resurgent Taliban has the potential to destroy the gains made during those 12 years. Difficult gains, tenuous threads of a democratic civil society revived. With Australian troops no longer in Afghanistan, are we powerless to help? Not according to international lawyer Susan Harris-Rimmer. In talking to women in both Afghanistan and another country undergoing massive transition, Myanmar, she and others argue that the rights of women in these countries are in danger of being traded away by the international community. She believes that diplomats are failing to put women's concerns at the centre of negotiations for peace, with big consequences. Dr. Susan Harris-Rimmer is an ARC Future Fellow in the Griffith Law School, about to embark on a very interesting study in both Myanmar and Afghanistan. Welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you for having me.
What do you mean by trading away women's rights? Let's head first to the situation in Afghanistan to illustrate what you see is happening and who's doing the trading.
Well, the term comes from women's rights advocates in Afghanistan. They've been pleading with the West to not trade away their rights now that the military have withdrawn, ISAF have withdrawn. And what they see as trading is issues like letting the domestic violence law stagnate in parliament without passing all this time. They're talking about female appointments in cabinet and in the courts being blocked by warlords. They're talking about the Taliban being courted and given incentives to demilitarise while their female victims, suffer poverty. So they're talking about essentially what the process would look like if women had actually were participating fully. And even when the West is holding the negotiations, so for example, there was a peace negotiation in Bonn and in Chicago, and even when the talks are held outside Afghanistan, there's still very little participation of women.
So even with women themselves in parliament, there has been this anxiety about the plight of women?
Yes, it's the female parliamentarians who are raising it. So there was a recent delegation of Afghan parliamentarians, a cross-party delegation, although the party system is a different thing in Afghanistan. They have a different voting system where parties are not the organising principle. And they are very concerned that the West is pulling its gaze away, essentially, particularly because of Islamic State and the issues in Syria and other places, the ongoing issues with Ukraine, the Greek financial crisis, all of these things that are happening, and they feel that the West would simply lose interest once the military have left.
Mm. How does this then translate to the plight of individual women, individual women's stories? What have you heard?
Well, amazing stories of courage. I mean, it is really difficult to be a proud women's rights advocate in both Myanmar and Afghanistan. Highly militarised places, a lot of violence, a lot of religious and other types of violence. So in Afghanistan, a woman was basically beaten to death by about 100 men outside a mosque with police watching on, because there was the idea that she had burnt a Quran, which she had not. Mm. So extraordinary kind of public violence and threats. And the woman who was the head of the Afghan Human Rights Commission, an extraordinary amount of bravery just to do what they do. And the bravery comes in different forms. They're also the women telling the West to stop killing civilians disproportionately. So these are the same women who were also criticising ISAF and NATO for what they saw as indiscriminate attacks on civilians. So, you know, we're talking about bravery in a wide range of directions, but they are determined not to go back to the situation they were in before 2001.
So what role does our own government and the wider international community have then?
Well, the rhetoric is good. The rhetoric is that we are replacing our military presence with a civilian presence, but our commitment doesn't change. That's the rhetoric. Mm. And so what I'm interested in is, well, prove it. Show me. Show me about, we've seen what's happened with the aid budget. And we know the difficulties of working in Afghanistan, but show me the commitment, the long-term commitment. I've been calling for a 10-year plan, a 10-year aid strategy and development strategy, as well as a diplomatic strategy to promote women's rights in Afghanistan, which is very similar to the one we have in the Pacific Women Shaping Pacific Development, because it's the long-term plan, the long-term commitment that Afghan women and Burmese women are looking for.
Yes, now you mentioned Burmese women, so take us to Myanmar. What issues are concerning you there in their particular transition?
Well, it's all about the elections over there at the moment. I mean, it's a lot of the debates about the role of women in public life and in politics centre around the lady, Aung San Suu Kyi. But, of course, there's a wide range of women wanting to participate in the elections. And the issues... They have a similar issue in the sense of they have a lot of ethnic minorities. It's incredibly linguistically and racially diverse with a strong majority group, the Burman Buddhist majority. And at the moment, what I'm investigating is these pretty scary laws called the interfaith marriage laws, and they are stopping Buddhist women, Burmese Buddhist women, from marrying anybody outside the faith without registration with very severe penalties. They're also saying that non-Buddhist women have to space their babies by 3 years. They're talking about maybe not registering certain marriages, and it's really directed at Rakhine State, at the Rohingya minority, the Muslim minority. But also there's the Kachin, there's Christian groups at the top of Burma. There's the Shan, the Karen. There's lots of different groups, and they're all wondering what their rights will be in the transitional state after the election. So it's a very fluid time. There's a lot of military violence, but there's also a lot of ethnic and religious-based violence. And, of course, there's been a lot of women for a long time on the border, refugees on the border who've been subject to human trafficking and other violations. And so there's pressure on all the refugees to return to Burma. There's so much going on. The other thing that Burma has, which is quite unique, is that it's been such a closed economic system for such a long time, and now the Western corporations are flowing in. So you get stopped at the traffic lights and people want to sell you an English copy of the foreign direct investment law, which is a new experience.
How surreal. What are the consequences, for example, under these laws of a Burmese Buddhist woman marrying outside her faith or religion?
Well, her property can be confiscated, which includes her land. This obviously works on many levels. Aung San Suu Kyi, of course, was famously married to a non-Buddhist man. She was married to an English gentleman, Christian. And so it will affect all the expats who've been living outside the country, possibly. So it works on a lot of levels, these laws, but the Buddhist monks actually drafted the laws and gave them to the parliament, and I suppose the shock was that the president then tabled them from debate, and that several of them have been passed. And again, this should be something that our politicians talk about loudly. It's a sign. It's always a bad sign when laws like this are passed, but we don't, because we have mining companies and other corporations that are seeking opportunities in Burma.
So business interests occupy that diplomatic relationship in a way that human rights interests don't.
Also, I think that there's that, and there's also the issue that somehow in the diplomatic mind, the political mind, these things are different. They're different. So in transitional justice studies, we talk a lot about the negotiations between male political elites, you know, combatants, politicians, religious leaders who are mainly male elites. When a law like this is passed, it's not naturally seen as part of the transitional justice regime. They see it as something private, cultural, different, something that we shouldn't get involved with.
Well, and there is a sense that Western governments feel uncomfortable imposing their particular interpretation of the rights of women on other societies.
Yes, that's right. But we don't feel the same sort of scruples in our economic system, our land titles, our foreign direct investment needs, our needs for our companies to have particular, you know, we have scruples in some areas and not in others, is what I'm saying. But if we want a transition that's sustainable, if we want a peace in Burma that's sustainable, we just can't ignore the rights of women.
And you're going to be interviewing women in both Kabul and Yangon, is that right?
Yangon, in Myanmar.
Over the next 4 years. But you've had experience of this transition process in East Timor. What are the lessons from Timor-Leste that could be applied to women's situations in Afghanistan and Burma?
Well, what I learned is we need to think about what the transition looks like from the lived experience of women. So don't bring our categories, our neat ideas with us. We just have to listen to what women are saying are their main issues. In Timor, a lot of the issues were around the bride price, around property ownership, around living with the militia, who were the sort of the small fish actors in the 99 violence, and so they had a range of issues, none of which necessarily were elevated to, you know, top issues in Burma, but that, in Timor, but they were top issues for half the population. So my view was also always that the UN didn't do enough to address itself to what women were telling them were their main issues. They were worried about domestic violence, which was absolutely soaring. They were worried about whether they could trust justice, police and courts when they've never been able to trust those sorts of mechanisms before. And they're worried about livelihoods, you know, economic rights for women in these transitional societies. It's so important, and we always think about the politics and not enough about livelihoods for women.
So you're travelling to Myanmar and Afghanistan in November this year. In Afghanistan, you're going to meet with various women activists. Who are they? Who will you be consulting as part of this research project? And these are women, I would imagine, who put their lives and limbs at risk every day.
Yes, well, because I'm looking at what Western governments can do better, I'm really looking at women who are engaging with the diplomats, with the embassies in country. And so that's a particular group of women. They often have education and English language skills and a profile, partly because it keeps them safer as well to have an international profile. So I'm not saying that I will be talking to necessarily ordinary women. I'm talking to leaders, and leaders who are trying to get international engagement. So again, a very specific group of people. So I'm talking to people who are journalists, who are the head of women's NGOs, who are in the Human Rights Commission, who are leading the push for girls in schools, girls' education, which is such a important issue, women who run domestic violence refuges, and women who are in parliament, but also in Afghanistan's very decentralised government, so local women's leaders from local councils, you know, lawyer jurgis are really important to my research. So it's a sample, and what I'm hoping is that they will tell us what strategies they would like Western diplomats to pursue. I think there's this paralysis we get of not knowing what to do, and so we don't do anything. So the idea is to give us a suite of options that at least will help us think, well, we can engage respectfully and, you know, cognizant of culture, but we can help Afghanistan meet its own voluntary obligations to women's rights that it has signed up to. So we're not imposing anything. This is a country that's made its own sovereign decisions. What can we do to help women in society hold Afghanistan to its promises? That's the idea.
At the top of that list, what do you think the priority would be?
Probably security at the moment, personal security, but not just from the Taliban, from domestic violence, family violence, intimate partner violence. There's just a high degree of physical insecurity in women's lives in both Burma and Afghanistan, and it was the same in Timor. You know, that it's not always the enemy that women are talking about. They're talking about what's going on in their families, in their villages. And the second thing is about economic livelihood, some sort of pathway where they can have a sustainable economic livelihood.
Yes, indeed. Look, good luck with the work. Look forward to touching base with you again about as you pursue it over the coming years. Susan Harris-Rimmer, thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Associate Professor Susan Harris Rimmer, ARC Future Fellow in the Griffith Law School, and she will be linking up with women in Afghanistan and Myanmar. And we in the West can support in all sorts of ways, so it will be interesting to see what emerges from her conversations with women in those two countries. Natasha Mitchell with you. Up next, the sex myth.